Case numbers 20-5117 and 20-5120, USA versus Josh Small and USA versus Johnny Johnson. Argument not to exceed 20 minutes per side. Mr. Shad, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'm here this morning representing Josh Small, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Yes.
Thank you. Your Honors, the government in this case with this prosecution is attempting to take a quintessential state home invasion robbery and federalize it. And in doing so, they're trying to put a square peg into a round hole, and it just doesn't work. This court should dismiss this prosecution against my client, as the evidence is not sufficient to convict him of federal kidnapping in this case. And I'm going to focus this morning on two of the elements of kidnapping in the time that I have with the court. But before I do that, I just kind of want to set the stage a little bit as to federal kidnapping and what it means. And I cited in my reply brief to the court the case of Chatwin versus United States. And that is a Supreme Court case from 1946. And I think it's highly instructive in this case because the Supreme Court really speaks to this prosecution when it made that decision in that case. So Chatwin is a case that came out shortly after the statute was promulgated by Congress, 18 U.S.C. section 1201. And the Supreme Court in Chatwin said that the reason there used to be a federal kidnapping statute, and then they took that, they actually exchanged that statute with this new statute, 1201. And the Supreme Court said the reason they did that was in direct reference to the Charles Lindbergh baby kidnapping. And so what they did was Congress actually expanded the language of the federal kidnapping statute to try to take into account what had occurred in that Lindbergh baby kidnapping. But the Supreme Court cautioned in moving forward, saying, even though there's expansive language in 1201, you cannot read 1201, each element in isolation without the other one. And you can't read it as so expansive as to expand federal kidnapping. And in that case, indeed, the facts of the case were that there was a young girl that was taken from Utah down to Mexico for something called a celestial marriage. And they determined that she wasn't taken against her will, and therefore she wasn't inveigled. But the government was trying to argue this broad, expansive view of what federal kidnapping is. And the government said, and the Supreme Court said, you can't do that. Federal kidnapping is for true kidnappings, and they're for true kidnappings where interstate commerce is involved, and this isn't one of those. So we fast forward to today, and we're having what is the government trying to expand federal kidnapping far beyond the reach of the federal jurisdiction. And so first, I'd like to talk a little bit about the interstate commerce and why interstate commerce wasn't met in this case. So interstate commerce can be met in one of three ways under the statute. One is you can take the kidnapped person across state lines. The second is you can cross interstate commerce in committing or in furtherance of the offense, or you can use an instrumentality of interstate commerce in furtherance of the offense. Obviously, the victim in this case, I believe her name was Mrs. Spoon, was not carried across state lines. As a matter of fact, she was only held for a very brief amount of period of time, and it was only within her home in the state of Tennessee that she was held. She was never taken in interstate commerce. So that is off the table. So now we just have the two that are left did the crime occur using interstate commerce? And so the government, when it made its argument to the jury, was arguing that the mere fact that my client crossed state lines was enough to meet this requirement. But the problem with that is that the government did not prove that he crossed state lines in furtherance of a federal kidnapping. In other words,
question, your client did cross the state line just before this happened, right?
He crossed the state line within 48 hours of this happening. That's correct, Your Honor.
So he was from Virginia and came across and stayed a day or two and then had this kidnapping.
That's,
if it was a kidnapping.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Had the robbery.
That's correct, Your Honor. But
that's
did your client also have a rental car that he rented in Virginia?
I believe, you know, I'd be hesitant to, I believe that's true. I know he had a car that he bought off of somebody that he was, I think a truck or something that he was actually caught in West Virginia 18 days later, but he may have rented a car too.
I thought that was also instrumentality of interstate commerce, that the car was rented in one state. It was driven across the other state where the abduction occurred. And I thought that was the argument. One of the arguments to satisfy the interstate nexus.
So I am remembering now, actually, I believe it was Joni Johnson's mother that actually rented that vehicle. And so it was sometime before then. So there was no proof that that vehicle was rented in order to further any kidnapping Tennessee.
Okay. But that's how that they went from Virginia to Tennessee, is in that rental car, right?
Well, certainly, Your Honor. But that's the problem.
And then so, they went back. Did they go back after they stole the possessions in the victim's house? They took those possessions with them from Tennessee back to Virginia in the rental car?
There's evidence that 18 days later they were in West Virginia. Yes,
Your Honor. West Virginia. Yeah.
But that's that is irrelevant, because I cited, of course, to the case of Rodriguez versus Moreno, or United States versus Rodriguez Moreno. And that is another U.S. Supreme Court case. And that is a 1999 case that says that once the victim is released, the kidnapping is over. So what happens 18 days later, whether they 18 days later drove a back across state lines, is irrelevant for purposes of whether or not the government proved an interstate commerce element in this case.
Okay, so it's only the crossing in it before the abduction?
Well, the government actually argues in its brief the fact that they used a car, and a car is in and of itself, you know, an instrumentality of interstate commerce, that's enough. But again, the problem with that is that's a very slippery slope, because literally every crime that's intrastate crime that uses a car now becomes a federal crime.
Well,
under that argument.
Well, arguably the car was rented, at least circumstantial evidence, which tend to demonstrate for this purpose of committing the crime. Then the car is used in interstate commerce to get to the crime scene, at which time the victim is held captive, and seemingly there's enough evidence for the jury to surmise that following the crime, the car moved in interstate commerce again to get back to West Virginia. That would seem to be enough.
Judge Clay, I see my time is up, if I can respond briefly.
Yes, please.
So there is no, Judge, I disagree, because there's no evidence in the record that that car was rented for the purpose of committing this crime. As a matter of fact, the car was rented by Joni Johnson's mother, who there's no allegation that she was involved in this crime in any way. And on top of that, Your Honor, there's no evidence in the record that they had even informed the intent to commit this particular crime before they passed state lines. There was actually a discussion during the Rule 29 argument with the district court, and the district court said, do you all have to prove that they formed the intent to commit this crime before they crossed state lines? They did not make any argument to the effect that they had to do that at all. That was never proven. There's no evidence of it. Without some evidence that they formed the intent before they crossed state lines 2 days beforehand, they just can't use that to prove this case.
Mr. Chad, did this couple do a series of these similar kidnappings and cross state lines with the other ones as well?
That was evidence that was brought out at sentencing. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so they've done other crimes that are just similar to this, and you say that they didn't form an intent to do this particular crime, but this is a pattern and practice, isn't it, of this couple doing these kidnappings?
Your Honor, the only thing that we can go by is the evidence that was presented at trial. We can't use the evidence that was presented at sentencing to show that the government proved the interstate commerce element at trial.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors. Gregory Napolitano for Appellant Joni Johnson. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. Good morning to counsel and good morning to counsel for the government, Mr. Kirk. I have 9 minutes and I have conferred with Mr. Shad and deferred our rebuttal time for Mr. Shad to handle the rebuttal. Picking up the discussion, Your Honors, if you wouldn't mind, where Mr. Shad left it off as it relates to this interstate commerce hook. I think we have little doubt that the members of the court could perhaps fashion out theories under which the government may have been able to prove up its case more assuredly, but they didn't. They are the masters of the litigation. The evidence at this stage is fixed, as are their arguments relative to how that evidence satisfies the elements of the crime. I cite in my reply brief the cases of Dunn versus United States and Chiarella versus the United States, which stands for the proposition that the government cannot go back and clean up at a later stage in the proceedings theories that will help to satisfy elements of a claim that were not presented at trial.
Notwithstanding that, even if the government missed something, we could affirm for any reason supported by the record.
To the extent that the reason is supported by the record, Your Honor, absolutely. However, if the theory is not posited before the jury, then I think ipso facto, it's not supported by the record. There is no evidence to tether whatever that isolated piece of evidence is to the element for which the government seeks to introduce it.
You had your jury instructions that instructed the jury as to the applicable law, and there was evidence introduced at trial about these perpetrators traveling from West Virginia and returning back to West Virginia. All that was presented to the jury, wasn't it?
Indeed it was. And in fact, what the government argued as it related to the jurisdictional hook was that the final element of the crime, the ransom or reward, and that is the kidnapping for ransom or reward, and there's a lot of emphasis in the federal statute placed on the word for, was completed across state lines in West Virginia when they, in the words of the government, cashed out their ill-gotten gains some 18 days later. That flies in the face of the Rodriguez case cited by counsel and also referenced by us in our briefing, in that once Ms. Spoon was let go, and that happened in her Tennessee home, minutes after she was bound, that crime had been completed. And so you cannot have elements that are grafted in to complete a crime days after the law says the crime itself has been completed. I point out in my initial briefing, the government knew of instrumentalities of interstate commerce. They reference a cell phone that was used to determine Mr. Small's location. There is reference made to a gun. The court is well aware, as is the government, of innumerable cases in which those instrumentalities are used to provide a jurisdictional hook. The government doesn't do that here. They don't put in the necessary additional evidence to bring did that. I believe because they felt that they could complete the crime days later with the cashing out of the ill-gotten gains. And we think the law does not support that construction. As it relates to the ransom reward or otherwise, I mentioned briefly, but want to reiterate, there is a connection in the law as it relates to the ransom and reward being tethered to the act of the confining, the kidnapping itself, in order to distinguish this crime from other crimes. We were talking a little bit in advance about the implications of what the government did here with regard to this evidence and its broadening of the potential for federal prosecutions. We live in a state, we live in a part of the state where people traverse the river from Kentucky to Ohio and back every single day. Now a little bit less conveniently with the bridge being out, but nevertheless, it does happen. One could envision circumstances where someone comes from Covington, Kentucky, holds somebody up at gunpoint in an alley in Main Street of Cincinnati, Ohio, takes their possessions, travels back home to Covington, and then at some point later turns that money or those possessions into money. Is that now a federal kidnapping? Applying the sort of broad analysis that the government urges here, it would be, so long as they used a car or so long as they went from Covington to Ohio and back. And that certainly can't be a federal kidnapping.
Well, what happened here, however, is that the perpetrators did hold this woman captive for a period of time there while they were ransacking her house. There was the element of her being held captive.
Indeed, there was, and they used cords to tie her up, and there's no disputing that evidence. But my understanding of the law is if you tie somebody up or you hold them at gunpoint, they're being held captive in either of those circumstances. And I was simply using that as an exercise to point out the slippery slope, as Councillor Shad mentioned, that occurs when we look at the application of the evidence here to the federal kidnapping statute. You know, in Chatwin, the court uses the phrase that the statute is intended to address true kidnappings. And it's also there to assist states in circumstances in which prosecutions of crimes, state crimes, for which they have plenary power, would be difficult. Where, you know, the federal government, the awesome power of the federal government is needed to address the issue. I would submit to your honors that here, state prosecutions could have proceeded without federal intervention, and there would have been very little difference in the ability to prosecute and even perhaps the ability to convict. There may even been less of a difficulty because if it's a state level prosecution, as the court well knows, the jurisdictional element is not necessary.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
Since the time of Chapman, of course, the federal government has moved into a lot of areas that the states used to have exclusive rights to. You got the Travel Act, you got the Hobbs Act, and lots of other acts like that too. The Firearms Act, you just have to prove some effect on interstate commerce. Every gun in the country, I guess, has an effect on interstate commerce. But that's the tendency of the federal government, is it not? Whether it's good or bad, but that's what it is.
Indeed, Your Honor, and that's why I cite in my reply a couple of cases in which of fairly recent vintage, at least for me, Lopez and Morrison, in which the high court has sort of said we've gone a little bit too far. The Guns in Schoolyards Act in Lopez and the Violence Against Women Act in Morrison, at which point, you know, the Supreme Court has recognized that there are outer limits to the application of the Commerce Clause to federalize criminal activity. And I would certainly submit that the Commerce Clause and fighting battles along Commerce Clause lines is difficult. But in a case such as this, it illustrates the difficulties when evidence is of such sort of paucity to make this federal is used in order to support very serious federal crimes. I think that when one looks to other cases in which the federalization of kidnapping has been allowed, there are circumstances in which we predominantly see victims being taken across state lines.
That was the old statute, though. That was before the Lindbergh kidnapping. That's what federal kidnapping was. And the amendments or the new kidnapping was was intended to broaden the federal power to prosecute kidnapping.
Indeed.
Was it
not? And I guess the question for the court under consideration here is how broad is appropriate? And we think this breaches that barrier. Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Alan Kirk of the United States. The convictions and sentences of Small and Johnson should be affirmed because the evidence at trial was sufficient for any rational jury to find that the defendants committed the elements of federal kidnapping and conspiracy to commit federal kidnapping. And additionally, the sentences in this case were both procedurally and substantively reasonable. First, the government proved the elements of federal kidnapping and conspiracy to commit federal kidnapping, and a jury returned a verdict of guilty as to both counts, and that verdict should be affirmed because the evidence at trial proved that the defendants traveled from Mercer County, West Virginia, in a rented Chevrolet Malibu, rented in Joni Johnson's mother's name, through Virginia to Tennessee in furtherance of the commission of their offense, crossing multiple state lines. They crossed into Tennessee and rented a hotel in Strawberry Plains, Tennessee, just east of Knoxville, the day before the crime, just the evening, afternoon before the crime happened on June 30th of 2018. The following morning, the two then traveled in the rented Chevy Malibu to Rocky Top, Tennessee, in a very rural area, sped into Miss Spoon's driveway, jumped out of the car, rushed her door, and Miss Spoon, sitting in her home, sees this happening, sees the Chevy Malibu coming to a halt in her driveway, and goes to the door to try to lock her door. However, Josh Small and Joni Johnson get to the door first, barge their way in, grab power cords from computers, power cords from, I believe, a lamp, and bind Miss Spoon's hands and bind her feet, hold her at gunpoint, and then get the reward at that point in time. After confining, seizing, and holding Miss Spoon, they then ransack her home, taking her valuables, her jewelry, cash, medicine, smashing a laptop computer because Josh Small couldn't get it to work. And then after about 20 to 25 minutes, after stealing the Spoon's things, their possessions, they then get back into the Chevy Malibu and then eventually return to their home in West Virginia. Because the government proved these facts to the jury, the crossing of state lines from West Virginia through Virginia to Tennessee, the crime happening, and then back to West Virginia with their reward, any rational jury could find that the elements of the offense were met. One point regarding the reward.
To show that this kind of conduct is a violation of the federal kidnapping statute.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I missed the very first part of your question.
Best case that you have to show similarity to this, because they say this is not a violation of the federal law.
Yes, Your Honor. The United States cited several cases in its brief. I would point the court. I think the best case would probably be the most recent would be the Dias case, even though that was an intrastate case. And that looked into mainly an instrumentality of interstate commerce in that particular case, a cell phone, but also the Sinsmeyer case as well, a kidnapping that did cross state lines, where the court looked into the reward of the taking and the holding of that victim for the defendant's purpose.
Mr. Kirk, the defendant committed a series of similar crimes here, but did those other crimes come out in this trial? They presented
during the trial, those other facts, those other incidences that spanned from West Virginia to Virginia and also other crimes that happened in Tennessee did not come out at trial. The only incident that came out at trial was involving Miss Linda Spoon in her home at Rocky Top.
Their argument is that there's no evidence that this was not a spontaneous criminal episode, that they could have decided just to drive from West Virginia to Tennessee, and then while in Tennessee decided to do this crime. I mean, that's a little contrary to the pattern and practice that we've got, but if the jury doesn't know that, it's not the evidence here. How do you rebut that argument, that there's no evidence that the crime was started in, or that actually was the plan of the crime was instigated in West Virginia and continued through to Tennessee?
Yes, Your Honor. Most defendants in criminal trials never admit their purpose or their intent, and usually that that has to be proved through circumstantial evidence, and that's what we did. So in this case, Small Johnson never stated that was their purpose. However, there is evidence where circumstantial evidence where a jury could infer that. One, they had a rented Chevy Malibu, a newer Chevrolet Malibu that was rented in Joni Johnson's mother's name. I believe it was Pamela Carter was her mother's name. Renting a car to travel across state lines, maybe to avoid detection by law enforcement. They traveled the day before checking into a hotel. I believe it was a Super 8 motel. The government placed that hotel receipt into evidence. I believe that was exhibit number 9. Staying in that hotel on June 29th, checking in on June 29th, 2018. And then the following morning, driving to Rocky Top, Tennessee, and finding their target's location, Ms. Spoon's location, on the morning of June 30th, the very next day, and then later checking out of that hotel and then being seen and returning to West Virginia. So based on that evidence before the jury can infer that they are traveling across state lines from their home in West Virginia in a rental car, not in either's name, getting in a hotel just less than 24 hours prior to the crime, and then after the crime occurred, traveling back to West Virginia.
All right. Defendants argue that the crime ended when they released the victim, and therefore the crossing of the state lines after the release of the victim cannot be factored in as to interstate commerce. Do you agree with that or not?
Well, Your Honor, the United States believes the crossing of the state line the day before, prior, into on June 29th, 2018, satisfies that element of...
So you don't rely on crossing the state line after they release the victim?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. They also argue that this is no different, that the confining the or tying up the victim to allow the theft of the house is no different than pointing a gun at a victim and having the victim comply with pointing a gun. And they argue that, you know, most robberies happen that way, that armed robberies, that the perpetrator will point a gun at the victim and then they will steal the property. And that's no different than here where you tie them up. And why is that different? And why wouldn't just a normal armed robbery be kidnapping under your theory?
Well, in this particular case, the reason it satisfies the elements is that the defendants crossed state lines with the purpose of holding, confining, seizing Ms. Spoon, and then getting their reward during that seizure, during that holding. And in this particular case, Joni Johnson did hold Linda Spoon at gunpoint as well, while Josh Small ransacked her home.
Okay, so that would be enough? They didn't need to tie her up?
That would be holding her at gunpoint is seizing her. That's confining her. That's holding her against the victim's will.
Okay. All right.
But in the facts of this particular case, however, Your Honor, is the photographs the government put into evidence makes a federal kidnapping prosecution even stronger. It's clear that Linda Spoon's hands were bound. It's clear her feet were bound. It was by her sheer effort, Ms. Spoon's sheer effort to shimmy her way loose, and thankfully finding a cell phone that Josh Mall didn't destroy or take in order to call for help and be set free.
I would like to ask you a question about the pre-sentence report in which they had other similar crimes, and these defendants have said that they really weren't identified in most of them, and there was no effort to show that they in fact committed these other crimes, which caused the court to vary upward in the sentencing. So tell me about that. What's the basis for being able to consider that in making the variance?
Yes, Your Honor. So the government made a motion prior to the sentencing hearing for an upward variance and put forward evidence, an abundance of evidence showing these defendants did in fact commit these other kidnappings, targeting and terrorizing other elderly and isolated victims across West Virginia, Virginia, and Tennessee. The evidence the government relied on consisted of testimony of law enforcement officers from various jurisdictions across Virginia, Tennessee, and West Virginia who investigated those kidnappings and home invasions. Those police reports taking statements from those victims at the time or shortly after the time of those home invasions. Unfortunately, some of those victims in the meantime, were either deceased or have ailed to the point where they cannot travel. They also conducted photo lineups with those victims where they identified the defendants. There was also other photographs and evidence brought by victims' family members that testified before the district court, and also a video that was played of one of the victims who was since deceased. I believe that was Mr. Clyde Moore, where a local news affiliate interviewed him, as well as testimony of another victim, Ms. Cleo Halsey, who testified where she was, her home was invaded in Mercer County, West Virginia.
Was this placed in the record before Judge Reeves, or how was it presented?
It was presented in the, to Judge Reeves. The government presented over the course of nearly 2 days of a sentencing hearing, presented that testimony and that evidence. There was even a video deposition that was played of by Ms. Cleo Halsey's neighbor, Dr. Cynthia Branson, who saw a vehicle on the day of Ms. Cleo Halsey's home invasion parked in her driveway and identified Ms. Joni Johnson sitting in the passenger seat of that vehicle within the hour or two of her home invasion occurring. So all that evidence was presented to the district court. And then the district court, Judge Reeves, made thorough findings on the record and found per Silverman that the factual allegations contained in the pre-sentence investigative report had indicia of reliability, and found that the defendants committed those other crimes by a preponderance of the evidence, which is the standard at sentencing. I would note as well that neither defendant properly objected to the factual allegations contained in the PSR. In the Eastern District of Tennessee, objections to the PSR must be filed within 14 days of receiving the PSR. The only objection that was filed in this case was an objection to the vulnerable victim enhancement filed by defendant Joni Johnson. However, defendant Small did object to the consideration of those other incidences within his sentencing memorandum, but it was a mere blanket bare denial of all those allegations. And Small even maintained his innocence at the sentencing hearing for all of those crimes. However, the United States did file a motion for upward variance and did intend and did present testimony and evidence to support that upward variance, and the court did grant it. And therefore, the sentences in this case, 30 years for defendant Small and then 25 years for Ms. Johnson, were procedurally reasonable and substantively reasonable. Per Rule 32, the district court provided to Small and Johnson what they would have gotten anyway had they properly objected, and that was a hearing. It was a nearly two-day hearing where the court heard evidence, heard testimony, made findings of fact. Both Johnson and Small's trial counsel were able to cross-examine government's witnesses and present argument. So they would have gotten, had they properly objected, anyway.
Did the defendants put on any evidence themselves in denial of that?
Other than a blanket bare denial, no, Your Honor. That was the only thing brought forth by both defendants. Your Honor, because the Small and Johnson traveled across state lines from West Virginia to Tennessee for the purpose in furtherance of the commission of the offense of federal kidnapping. And because the United States put on evidence of that crime and the jury found that the United States met those elements and returned a verdict of guilty, the convictions of both Small and Johnson should be affirmed. So because of the reasons set forth in the United States brief, the United States asked that the court confirm Small and Johnson's convictions and affirm both sentences. Thank you.
Thank you, and we'll hear rebuttal at this time.
Thank you, Your Honors. So the interstate commerce element here is an ever-moving target. So when they argued it to the jury, they said that it was the fact that they had that they traveled after the fact back to West Virginia so that they could go to the pawn shop. That's what they argued. In their brief, they argued that it was an instrumentality, that the use of the pawn shop and the fact that they used a vehicle were enough to show the interstate commerce. Now today, here we are, and their main argument is going to be that it was when they traveled before the event that that was the interstate commerce. Here's the problem, and it relies on the fact that they have to prove that when they went across state lines, that they were already in the process of committing or furthering the kidnapping offense. That's what the statute requires when they cross state lines on the 29th. And they want to use the fact that there was this rental car to help prove to the court that there was the intent. Well, take a look at it's page ID 789, which is the testimony of the FBI agent. And it's the testimony regarding the Enterprise rental car. That Enterprise rental car not only was rented by Pamela Carter, but it was rented at the beginning of June. This offense didn't happen until the end of June. So what they're saying is at the beginning of June, they had already somehow formed the intent to do this, gotten Joni's mother to rent the car, waited a month, and then went ahead and went over across the state lines.
Why does it matter when the car was rented? Let's say the mother had rented the car, purchased the car 2 years ago, but the perpetrators are deciding now today we're going to use this car in interstate commerce. Maybe the car wasn't even a newly acquired car, but they only make the decision to use the car in interstate commerce around the time that they commit the crime. Why wouldn't that be enough?
Well, the reason it makes a difference, Your Honor, and the reason it's important is that the opposing counsel just argued to you the fact that they used a rental car was so that they could avoid detection. So that's why they used the rental car. So,
seven on the pod from what was being argued just then, if they decide to use a vehicle in interstate commerce, forget what the government is arguing themselves. Why isn't that enough?
Well, if they form the intent to commit the kidnapping before they cross state lines, whether they use a car or whether they walk across state lines, it doesn't matter. But the government still has to prove that they have to present evidence to a jury that they informed the intent before they cross state lines. And that's what's lacking here, Your Honor.
Well, they traveled to the destination with some objective in mind. They didn't travel to the victim's residence for no purpose. So anybody would surmise that they went there to do what they did and that they formed the intent before they went there or around the time that they went there. Well, I'm not really understanding the argument that you're making.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree that any jury could have made that leap from the evidence to that. And I'll more point out that the government presented evidence that it wasn't that they went to Rocky Top where this crime occurred the day before. They went to Knoxville. The government made pains to show that they went out to eat, that they enjoyed themselves, that they were taking a little vacation. As a matter of fact, they showed evidence that after that fact, they stayed at the same hotel another 2 days. So it's equally and easily the same argument that they actually crossed state lines so that they could go on a vacation. While they were on the vacation, then they made the decision to go ahead and commit this crime. And then they committed the crime, which was a state home invasion. And that brings us to the issue of we just don't know because the government didn't present any evidence on the intent prior to crossing state lines.
Let me ask you this. How long had they been in Tennessee at the time they committed the crime?
Somewhere between 24 and 48 hours.
Thank you.
But they were there for another 16 days thereafter. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you for your arguments, and the case shall be submitted.